oneness. Hi, everyone. I'm Christopher Kakuyo Sensei, and I'm a sensei of the Salt Lake Buddhist Fellowship. We are an independent, transsectarian, all-inclusive American sangha in the Mahayana tradition. The Way of Oneness podcast is a collection of our Dharma talks delivered at our Salt Lake City Fellowship Sangha. Enjoy the Dharma talk.
Refuge to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And the next step in becoming formally a Buddhist is to take the five precepts. The five precepts have been an important part of lay practice from the very beginning of the Buddhist Sangha some 2,500 years ago. In fact, most lay practitioners, meditation was not something they did. For non-monastic followers of the Buddha, the five precepts were the practice. Things have changed a lot since then, and lay people practicing meditation has become ubiquitous and more universal in the past 100 some years. Before that, it was pretty unheard of. If you would have gone to a Tibetan Lama 150 years ago and said, I want to meditate, they would have looked at you like, nobody does that, just that crazy guy up on the hill does that. And things have changed a lot. For many in the West, the five precepts have become a vestige of the old ways of living, the too reminiscent feeling of the thou shalt nots of their previous tradition, and therefore there's some negative view that persists about the five precepts. Achan Cha, the famous Theravada teacher, once said, quote, the Buddha Dharma has three aspects, dana, giving, sila, precepts, and bhavna, cultivation or meditation practice. But when Westerners come to the practice, they aren't interested in giving or precepts, they just want to do meditation. End quote. Even the Buddha said in the Pali Canon, what good is there revering me and my teachings if you are all the whole violating my precepts? End quote. So evidently, the precepts are an integral part of our practice, and most people don't realize in the early tradition, they were the prerequisite for effective meditation. Following the Eightfold Path to the Buddha starts with ethical action, then meditation, and then cultivation of wisdom. I think this is important to see and to understand. So here's a story to illustrate my point. There was a study done in the UK that looked at Western meditators and yoga practitioners, and the study wanted to see what effects there were on their practice. The results were not what they expected. The findings of the study were that contemporary meditation and yoga practices could actually inflate the ego self. The study found people had a higher opinion of themselves after the exercise of mindfulness. Look how woke I am. Western Buddhists may encourage people to focus on their personal anxieties that also may promote self-improvement rather than overcoming selfishness. It's important to say that these outcomes are not in themselves negative, though I think they do illustrate the end goals of more traditional Buddhist practice are different than what some mindful practitioners' goals may be. The teachings of the Buddha Dharma are not about self-improvement or even better self-esteem, but are rooted in the transcendence of suffering and our deep woundedness through the realization of oneness. To accomplish these things, the first things that the Buddha taught was relinquishing our identification with the small self and opening ourselves up to the identification with the interdependent or universal self. The Buddha's realization of non-self was an important element of his awakening to how we overcome suffering. The question I pose is, when does a new culture, when the teachings come to a new culture, They find an audience that has different needs, and there's a tension with the teachings rub up against the values of the new society. Many times there's this really great synergistic thing that happens, such as between India and China. The question I pose is, when does a new culture dilute something so much that it's no longer the same thing? A fellow lay minister, C.J. Dio Sensei from the Bright Dawn Way of Oneness Sangha, has cautioned that we may not simply want to disregard 2,500 years of field-tested Buddhist practice. The authors of the study noticed this tension when they hypothesized why the results came out the way they did. Quote, Western practitioners of Buddhism fail to practice with an eye towards the selflessness that should characterize the goal of these efforts. Though through yoga and meditation were originally intended as ways to calm the ego, many non-Buddhist practitioners do these activities with an eye to self-improvement or simply calming personal anxieties. End quote. This has been something that other writers have noticed, the more therapeutic aspect of Buddhist teachings, and this makes sense in the hyper-individualistic society as ours, in addition to our capitalist worldview, where we sell everything as a mindfulness product. Mindfulness stuff is hot product right now. Have you noticed? Everything is mindful. Mindful sex, which is usually better. Mindful consumption, mindful auto mechanics, mindful high colonics. Yes, I just said that. It's become so prevalent, there's now a term called McMindfulness, which has been coined as a tendency for Westerners to market everything mindful. Mindful golf, mindful eating, mindful investing. Mindful is the new missing ingredient in everything, from your 401k to your gardening. Your retirement will be greener, and so will your garden. But simple mindful awareness is only part of the practice. A very important part of the practice is called sila, or shila, and it is the ethical component of the Buddha Dharma. This component is found in the five precepts of the Eightfold Path. So what are these five precepts? The first precept is to affirm life, to refrain from killing, and a commitment to non-harm. The second precept is to be giving, and to refrain from taking or stealing. The third is to honor your body and the bodies of others, to refrain from misusing sexuality, which evidently is an issue in the Buddha Sangha, if you've watched the news of late. The fourth is manifest truth through being honest with yourself and others, or to refrain from lying. And the fifth is to proceed clear-mindedly. Do not cloud the mind and refrain from things that do. Now, some have compared these five precepts as the five commandments of Buddhism, but you will notice something right off from the language being different. The Judeo-Christian commandments are in the language of thou shalt not. And it's something brought to us from God. The precepts are not. You will also notice that we have purposely written them in the language of practice. Thich Nhat Hanh has put the five precepts into the language of mindfulness, and he actually calls them the five mindfulness trainings. They are reverence for life, to refrain from killing, true happiness, to refrain from stealing, true love, to refrain from misusing sexuality and intimacy, loving and compassionate speech, to refrain from lying, nourishment and healing, to refrain from intoxicants, and to practice mindful consumption. He goes on to say about the trainings, quote, the first training is to protect life, to decrease violence in oneself, in the family, and society. The second training is to practice social justice, generosity, not stealing, and not exploiting other living beings. The third is the practice of responsible sexual behavior in order to protect individuals, couples, families, and children. The fourth is to practice deep listening and loving speech to restore communication and reconcile. The fifth is about mindful consumption, to help us not bring toxins and poisons into our body and mind." End quote. You will notice from the language of each of the precepts is more about a practice and not a dogmatic black and white injunction. Each of the precepts invites us to not simply obey, but to engage with what each of these mean for us in our individual lives and circumstances. We look at the precepts aspirationally as what it means to live the life of a Buddha. The first thing we need to remember about the five precepts in the field of practice is that they are a field of practice and not a checklist of our failures. I know that feeling from the commandments. I felt that they were a continual checklist of my failure. Our relationship with the precepts can be contemplative in nature, and whose manifestation comes from within in a natural outflowing instead of guilt or shame or some external ideal. The ethical idea is not something outside of ourselves, but something that comes from within us and flows outward. They are the practice that brings us into harmony with all things. As John Dido Laurie, the abbot of the Zen Mountain Monastery, writes, "To practice the precepts is to be in harmony with your life and the universe." It's interesting to observe Western Buddhist relationship with the precepts. Some don't even think about them, and others can be outright fundamentalists. There are, ironically, plenty of black and white Buddhist practitioners. You may have bumped into a few on a Facebook forum. It's hard to change our relationship to certain ethical guidelines because we are a manifestation of all the causes and conditions coming out of our theistic traditions. It can be hard to let go of the prescriptive certainty, the black and white of the thou shalt nots. I have seen fellow Buddhists, of course, on social media, calling each other out regarding eating meat or being only vegetarian, about drinking or not drinking, about sex, going off how a white lie to your grandmother is violating the precept against lying, and on and on and on. Buddhism teaches that there are 10 fetters, mental chains that keep us bound. One of them is the dependence on moral rules and religious observance as an end to themselves. We get bound to our stories of who we are. We set ourselves above others. I don't drink. I'm a vegan. I engage in activism. I don't engage in activism. Therefore, I am a good Buddhist. I am a better Buddhist than you. And what does that make all the other Buddhists that don't? I have taken the precepts. I am more Buddhist than you. Did you notice even the precepts removed from mindfulness increases the size of our egos? We're constantly, constantly working on that. Here's an important thing to remember, as Daido Roshi writes, quote, "Taking the precepts makes us a servant of other people, not superior to them. Our vow is to be a servant to all beings. Buddhas do not put themselves above anything. In a Buddha, there is no separation." End quote. So let's see how we can approach the precepts by looking at the first precept about affirming life. I think of the first precept as a training in nonviolence. Obviously, the first precept is about all of us not killing each other, but it also extends to non-humans. The word pana in Pali refers to anything breathing and conscious. We are to practice nonviolence towards animals as well as humans. This is why many Buddhists choose to be vegetarian. Some of you have made that choice. I, too, recently have made that choice, and we can look at it as a part of our mindfulness training. That being said, that does not mean you have to be a vegetarian to be a Buddhist. Not all Buddhists are vegetarian. Though I have had a conversation with some to say that it isn't enough to be a vegetarian, that to truly be Buddhist, you must be a vegan. That would be new to the Buddha. The Buddha would eat meat when offered to him. The monastic rule against eating meat was that monks were not to eat if it was killed specifically for them. It would not be okay for them to eat. Better to eat the meat than to have the loss of its life for nothing. The only meat that was forbidden for the monks to eat by the Buddha was human and tiger. I have no idea why tiger. Probably catching a tiger to eat it would be really dangerous. The Buddha was practical. Seeking alms, the monk were to learn to take whatever food was given, showing no preference. But the monk was never to kill an animal for food. Intention was the core of all the teachings with karma. It wasn't as much as eating of the meat as it was the state of mind that brought the animal to its death. It was the action of the doer that was the concern. Much of this is workable when you have a society large enough to supply food for wandering monks. If you do not live somewhere where there is no other food source, you would be allowed to kill it for food. Again, it's important to note that not all Buddhists are vegetarian. Does that mean they are not good Buddhists? Buddhism is not dogmatic. It asks us to engage with the teachings. I like the way one teacher put it. Quote, this is what Buddhism asks us to do, to investigate the circumstances of our lives, to live with difficult questions and address them as best we can in the moment, to see how far we can go from refraining from killing in our lives, knowing that the extent to which we are willing to go may change and evolve as we proceed along the path. End quote. Here's another reflection from Tatetsu Uno Sensei. Quote, the universe of difference between believing that humans have the right to take other forms of life with impunity and having to do so with a deep sense of shame, regret, and repentance. The least a person can do, then, is to be grateful and not waste nature's gifts. When we see that human beings do not occupy a special privileged place in the web of life, then humility and gratitude should be natural and spontaneous. Yet the difficulty in arriving at this understanding is immense. End quote. The mindfulness training of affirming life can come in many different forms. Death is an inevitable fact of life, but that does not mean that we do not affirm life. Indigenous people affirm the lives of the animals they hunt, have ceremonies and prayers for the animals that gave their lives for them. They even see the animals as their ancestors that have returned to feed them. There is a similar example in Buddhism. I like this example from Tosca Kabara, who wrote an essay called Bodhisattvas Everywhere. Quote, the thought really hit me. I eat fish and daikon. Daikon is a form of radish. The daikon itself wants to live. It grows up, blossoms with flowers, but we take the daikon at the prime of its life and eat it. So the things which I had thought of as being in the world of animals have become the things of my own world, of myself. Shift. As I thought in this way, I began to feel that everything such as fish, animals, and daikon came to appear to me as bodhisattvas. They sacrificed their own bodies and lives to sustain my own life. End quote. So this is one of the ways that we can engage with the first precept as part of our practice. Another way is to look at it is to stress the import of saving lives instead of taking life. Not taking life is not doing something, but what small things can we do to save lives right now? How about save the life of this planet? I would like to close with two quotes, the first from Thich Nhat Hanh and the second from Geshu Jinji, a 7th century Buddhist priest. The first quote is from Tay's mindfulness training on the practice of the first precept, which in itself could be the practice of your whole life, and is more important now than any other time in our planet's history. Quote, aware of the suffering caused by the destruction of life, I am committed to cultivating the insight of interbeing and compassion and learning ways to protect the lives of people, animals, plants, and minerals. I am determined not to kill, not to let others kill, and not to support any act of killing in the world, in my thinking or in my way of life. Seeing that harmful actions arise from anger, fear, greed, and intolerance, which in turn come from dualistic and discriminative thinking, I will cultivate openness, non-discrimination, non-attachment to views in order to transform violent fanaticism and dogmatism in myself and in the world. End quote. And these last lines from a poem by Geshu Zhenji. These lines are for all of those, for all of us, but especially for those who have taken the precepts or who are planning to take the precepts at our retreat. Quote, when all sentient beings receive the Buddha's precepts, they enter the realm of the Buddhas, and their position is the same as that of the great enlightened person. Indeed, they are the children of the Buddhas. End quote. May we all become children of the Buddhas and walk intentionally and awake into our lives using the precepts as our guides. Namu Amida Butsu.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. The Way of Oneness is produced by the Salt Lake City Buddhist Fellowship, an all-inclusive, trans-sectarian American Sangha in the spirit of Bright Dawn Way of Oneness Buddhism. To learn more about the fellowship, please contact us at saltlakebuddhist.org. Our website will give information about meetings and other services that we provide the community. Again, thank you for listening.